What's up, everybody? Welcome back to another episode of Orale Ball Heights. My guest today is Dr. Laura Enriquez. Laura, introduce yourself to folks.
Hi, I'm Laura Enriquez, and I'm a associate professor in Chicano Latino Studies at UC Irvine.
Yeah, thank you for joining me today on this weird Thursday, given that we're still in the middle of a pandemic, and we don't know when we're going to get out of it.
This is true, but I love talking to you, so I'm glad to be here.
Yeah, we've known each other for a long time. We'll get into that history in a little bit, but it's weird that we're reconnecting again, because now so much has changed. And when we were talking before starting recording, just kind of reminiscing about things, and yeah, to me it still trips me out that the majority of the folks that I was organizing with and hanging out with so long ago are now parents.
Yes, we've grown up. I mean, but it's been 11 years.
Yeah, it's been, I mean, that's just how time has been flying. So, I mean, there was a good chunk of time, specifically after I turned 30, when all of that was just happening at once. And I was like, whoa, this is really weird. Like,
yeah.
You see it in TV shows and you read about it, but then like it's actually happening to me. It's like, wow, am I missing out? Am I not? I felt like that at some point, where I thought I wasn't doing something right because I wasn't going down that path of, like, you know, becoming quote unquote an adult, home ownership or stable housing at that point when I was at that age, getting kids and having all that, those kind of responsibilities. And now 36, I was like, yeah, I'm okay with that. I don't want any of that. It's fine.
I think there's different ways to become an adult, and you can pick the path that you want, as long as you can make your choices and they're not made for you.
Yeah, I think that's what I've been coming to terms in my own way, right? That acceptability and that okayness, that yeah, what you're doing is fine, you know. It's not toxic, it's not bad. It's like you're just doing your own thing, and because it's so different than what is normalized, then that's what kind of gives it that feeling of being the odd man out. All right, well, you are an associate professor of Chicano Latino Studies at Irvine. How long have you been at Irvine now? Like a couple of years, right? Wow, really? 5 years? Felt like it was just yesterday. And before that, I think you were teaching at...
Before that, I was in graduate school at UC.
Weren't you teaching at Claremont at one point?
No, I went to school in Claremont.
You went to... Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, yeah. I'm getting my history mixed up here. But yeah, thank you again for coming on the show. Aside from like the interview I'm going to do with Laura and get into it right now, the big thing we wanted to get into today was the book you just published in April, which you've been working on over the last couple of years, which is titled Of Love and Papers, How Immigration Policy Affects Romance and Family. So the quick blurb of it is, it's your research and talking to folks about being in relationships and romantic relationships while being undocumented themselves, or being in a relationship with somebody who is undocumented or who has citizenship, and the mixed bag that you get in so many folks, you know, connecting with each other. So I'm excited to talk about it because I'm also in it as well.
If you want to admit then you're in it, then that's your prerogative.
Yeah. But yeah, so I mean, we'll get into the book and everything, but I did want to ask you, can we talk about how we first met? What was that like? Paint the picture.
When we first met, I feel like we were in a meeting for when we were starting Dream Team LA. So I feel like that's how I definitely met you. So it must have been in a meeting. And I feel like I want to say it was like at MALDEF.
What was Dream Team LA?
So Dream Team Los Angeles was an organization that was being found, that, well, I guess was founded in LA to focus on passing the Dream Act in 2009. Mm-hmm. So I was like, I don't even know how I got involved. I was doing work with undocumented students at UCLA and got invited to a meeting, I think, in downtown because we were trying to create some kind of broader network to bring folks together and coordinate activism. So I'm not sure how you ended up there, but I think I just kind of joined some folks that I was hanging out with and found my way to a meeting.
Well, for you specifically, being at UCLA, you were hanging out with folks who were part of the undocumented group at UCLA, which is called IDEAS. And for the life of me, I can't remember the acronym it stands for. It's a lot of acronyms to keep track of. But that's how you came in. Because, yeah, for me, it was very similar that I was at UCLA College at the time. And folks who were organizing a group of, you know, a support group for undocumented students at ELAC were also part of the larger network of community college-based groups that was organized by CIRLA. Did that network have a name? I can't remember off the top of my head. California Dream Network. Yeah, so it was a whole statewide group of coalition of, you know, support-based organizations at different schools up and down the state, and CIRLA, the nonprofit, was the one at the helm kind of organizing it and providing support to folks and, you know, doing what they do, which is supporting undocumented, at the time, undocumented students who were in college. So Dream Team LA came out of that, where I remember folks graduating from school, and I mean, and this is just me telling it the way I understand it. You know, other folks will tell you their experience, but my understanding was that as soon as folks started graduating from college, the ones that were older, you know, and were doing it a lot longer than others, they weren't allowed to be part of the network anymore for one reason or another. It's not like they were getting kicked out or whatever, like, you can't join us. So that kind of facilitated the need for outside groups that weren't, you know, college-based or based on very circumstantial situations where, like, if you're not in this circumstance, you can't be a part of it, right? So that's what facilitated, my understanding, the creation of Dream Team LA. And yeah, being connected with the folks at ELAC and learning about the network and CIRLA and everything that was going on, that's how eventually I was able to connect with folks to be part of Dream Team LA. And I still remember, like, some of those meetings, because it was really random and really telling of, you know, that a bunch of college students were just trying to organize and do this thing, because we would have meetings at the most random places sometimes.
I mean, I feel like that was part of the intention. We were trying to, like, move it around to LA so it could be more inclusive, but it made it more confusing.
To be inclusive, to be easy, so it could be easier for other folks from different parts of town to be able to attend it and participate. And a lot of the other things that you want to accommodate folks, it's that it's easy to find, accessible via public transportation. There's plenty of parking, plenty of free parking, I might add. So yeah, a lot of fun times there, organizing for the Federal Dream Act and making a lot of long lasting relationships and friendships like the one we have. So yeah, that's where we ended up meeting. And at the time, you already started your graduate.
Yeah.
So what were you focusing on?
So I was doing my PhD in sociology at UCLA. And at that time, I was doing work more around social movements, right? So undocumented young adults advocating for the Dream Act. And that's some of the earlier work that I was doing. And I think that's how I was doing that work at UCLA and then kind of got pulled into Dream Team LA. We were made co-chairs of fundraising. Do you remember that?
No. The worst person for fundraising.
Well, we made some controversial fundraising decisions because they didn't uphold diverse, you know, deservingness narratives. We were ahead of our time in trying to tackle narratives of deservingness and how they were negative for the movement.
Oh my God, I remember that. Yeah.
So I mean, I was doing that kind of work on social movements and how to, like, the work I was doing was coalition building and how coalitions are built and sort of roles that undocumented students and citizens play within movements and how you can sort of make those the most effective coalitions. But then being in this, you know, these organizing spaces actually got me more interested in focusing on sort of social experiences. Right. And that's kind of what shifted my work more into focusing on romantic relationships and families.
So it was initially, it wasn't a big shift to go from one to the other. Like, you were already in that field. It's like, all right, well, you know, now I'm just going to focus on this.
And I think before that, I was doing like educational access for undocumented students. Like, that was sort of my initial work. So I've always been doing work around undocumented students. But it was just kind of shifting based on what I was doing and experiencing at that time and where I wanted to focus my energy, and sort of where I saw important things that I felt like should be written down.
Yeah, because, I mean, at the time, this, we're talking about early 2010s, like late 2000s. So a lot of this research wasn't as available as it is now, right? Where folks like yourself have, you know, turned that work into books, have published it. The larger narrative and profile of undocumented folks going to school, which now is referred to as like folks, you know, being dreamers, which is like its own thing. We might get into it. I don't know. We'll see where the conversation goes. But yeah, back then, these was the early stages for a lot of that research that has yet to be published and put out there. And for a lot of those narratives that are super common now for a lot of folks, when you hear them in the news or you hear folks talk about DACA and how's that impacting folks. So yeah, I did want to ask you this. Why policy? Why research? Why study that in school when there are so many other things?
I found my way to sociology because I wanted to like talk about people. A lot of it was about understanding my own experience. So that was one of the first places where I was able to understand like my family's own immigration history. I remember being an undergraduate and reading a book that talked about like the early 90s in California and anti-immigrant sentiment and Prop 189 and all this, you know, all this stuff. And realizing like, this is why I don't speak Spanish, because this was the context in which I would have been taught Spanish and that you couldn't speak Spanish in public places. So I think that was a really important realization for me, and to have that in a class was what really drew me into sociology and to have those experiences. And then I just fell in love with it, and I really like doing research because I got to talk to people. So I do mostly interview-based research, although now I'm sort of dabbling in, I guess I'm not dabbling, I do also survey research. But I interviews are what I really like to do because I like talking to people and understanding their experiences and trying to bring all those pieces together and tell a story, right? And I think with the book, it was bringing together all of the chisme. I mean, there's really no other way to put it. I mean, I think it's more than just chisme, right? It's people's lives, and I recognize that, and that's important. Yeah. But I think other people look at it and see, you know, that's just gossip and people's, you know, boyfriend drama, and who cares? But I think that it tells us a larger story about something that's really important. And I like pulling all those pieces together.
How many folks do you think you've interviewed up to this point?
Like ever?
Like, yeah, just period.
I want to go with like over 500.
Wow, that is incredible.
It's a lot of people. But I would say I've probably done, actually, I mean, just for the book, that was like 250 interviews because there were two waves. And before that, there were other ones. So I would say I'm probably closer to maybe like 350, just sort of on my own. But yeah, it's a lot of people that I've talked to.
Yeah, in the ballpark. I mean, because I imagine in the very beginning, when you were starting your career, you were doing a lot of these interviews. You know, you didn't have the resources that you have now, where, you know, you can get people to do it for you, or they can come on and be part of the project and while helping you, you know, get experience doing it themselves too. So
I like to think that we're doing it together.
Yes.
Not that they're doing it for me. But yeah. No, and I think now I kind of miss doing it. Because I do a lot of the work with students, so the students are the ones that do a lot of the interviews, and I miss talking to people. And it's just sort of a different experience. Yeah.
I can see that. Because in the book, yeah, you describe where, you know, a lot of these interviews for the book specifically, you were interviewing folks at a lot of different places. I don't think you were ever at the same place twice unless you were interviewing the same person. So it was a mix of people's homes, people inviting you into their homes, coffee shops, parks, restaurants. Was there one place where you're like, oh, that's, I've never done an interview there. That's interesting.
No, I think now I still drive around and I'm like, oh, I've done an interview there. And Miguel thinks I'm crazy, my husband. But I do that, you know, in Irvine. And that's before I even lived here. I do that in LA. I do that in Riverside. Like I was all over, and, you know, in the Valley, like just, I was all over Southern California talking to folks.
Meeting people where they're at. Yeah. Well, I mean, I was hoping to hear something like somebody ask you to do the interview at a movie theater or something.
No, I have not done an interview at a movie theater. I don't think I would have agreed to that. I'll say, I like early on, my default was Starbucks or coffee shops, right? Yeah. But those are actually not good places for interviews because of blenders in the summer. Did you know? Because the blenders would go off all the time. So actually my research assistant is the one who realized that McDonald's is a really great place. Because it's quiet.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. You get Wi-Fi now.
That wasn't so much of an issue then, but yeah, I guess now that would be an upside maybe. Or maybe now folks are there, it's less quiet because there's Wi-Fi, but like it was a pretty good place to interview folks. But I liked parks. I guess maybe the weirdest place I interviewed somebody like during a baby show. Huh. That was kind of weird.
It's like that was the only time they were available.
I guess. I mean, they were having a baby shower and then we like walked off to another bench at the park and like did an interview. And I think maybe they thought it was going to be fast, but it was like 2 hours because I talked a lot. And then afterwards I attended the baby shower.
Got some cake. All right. So in terms of your research and moving forward in your career, how has it been settling into the place you're in now, which is like teaching and kind of, you know, being able to have more say in what's going on? And the, like we were talking about before we started recording, that you are not using that as a way to create programs and help create the structures inside institutions to help undocumented students. So how's that been for you?
Yeah, I definitely have focused a lot of my energy now within the institution and trying to make space for undocumented students. I do a lot of work with the Dream Center at UCI, which supports undocumented students. So I'm faculty in residence there and have done a lot of work creating programs for them, bringing graduate students and, you know, creating fellowships for graduate students to work with the center and creating professional opportunities for them, but also creating professional development opportunities for undergraduate students, thinking about how do we help them navigate their undocumented status as they're trying to access professional development opportunities like internships or research. How do we help them frame their immigration status or maybe non-traditional kinds of professional activities as things that they can talk about in their resume or not talk about? How do you explain gaps in the resume that might otherwise present problems in an interview or things like that? So I do a lot of work there. I also do... I'm faculty advisor for a residential hall at UCI that's focused on supporting undocumented students, and we do a lot of programming for them. And then, I mean, I've just done a lot of things, you know, like administrative things. I don't know if they're administrative. Behind the scenes, maybe, is kind of how I think about it. So advocating to administrators and writing reports and things like that that help direct funding or draw attention to particular issues that need to be addressed. So I'm in a lot. I get to be in a lot of those meetings where decisions are being made, and help direct funds in ways that will support undocumented students and make sure that our policies are inclusive.
Yeah, I can imagine you being at those faculty meetings and being the voice of reason as something is being proposed, and you know, I'm imagining you're raising your hand and saying, well, what about this? Because if you do this, then it's going to impact folks in this negative way, and nobody in the room even considered that.
Yeah, definitely. Folks are not always, I would say, yeah, folks are not always thinking about it or haven't thought about it, or they're focused on something else that maybe is not as much of an issue. So I would say, especially when there is lots of things going on around DACA and threats to DACA, right? So the rescission and all this other stuff that has happened over the past couple of years, there's been a lot of preoccupation with deportation or other kinds of things that faculty or administrators decide to focus on, like this is the thing that needs to be addressed based on what they think, right? But that's not really grounded in needs that have been established by undocumented students, right? Or the affected communities. So there's a mismatch between what folks think and what is actually happening on the ground. I feel like I do a lot of translating.
A lot of connecting. Have you ever at one point quoted your work? I'd be like, well, according to my research.
I don't usually say it like that, but yeah. I draw on my research to make recommendations.
To prove your point. So like, that's right. You sit down, faculty member. I'm the expert in this field. Let me tell you how it really is.
I've had somebody quote me back to me before.
So oh, wow.
That was weird.
Yeah, so... Since you mentioned a lot of the supportive work you're doing on the back end and the public facing end, the way we're talking about it seems like this has been the norm, but it hasn't. Like, how, paint a picture for folks. How have things been, you know, before, I guess institutions got quote unquote more woke about being more supportive about to undocumented students?
I mean, I think it's changed on a lot of different levels, right? And this is sort of the new project that I have going on, that my next book project is focusing on sort of the change in California's higher ed support for undocumented students over the past, you know, 15, 20 years. And I mean, I think I feel weird talking about like, oh, this is what it used to be like, because that was also your experience and it wasn't my experience, right? So I think that, you know, early on after AB 540 and, you know, there was access to in-state tuition, which made it financially accessible. But for, you know, 10 years, there was no access to financial aid, or even longer till 2013. So that gap of 11 years made it really difficult to actually afford, you know, going to college. I'm not telling you anything new.
Well, you're not telling me, you're telling the audience.
That's true. That was a very difficult period. There wasn't a lot of institutional support, right? Or if there was support, it was very institution specific, right? It was dependent upon finding someone who was an ally, who was going to be very committed, that was going to find a way for you, but that was very spotty, right? And that's really where undocumented student organizations, right, came up and created these spaces and advocated for students. And I think that was a very important role, right, that students were playing in advocating for themselves and then advocating for, right, the California Dream Act and access to financial aid. So I think we see a big shift there when financial aid became available in 2013, which also overlaps with the creation of DACA, right? So now we also have work permits. And I think that really opened the doors, those two things together, to bring folks into school, to give them access to a lot of things in terms of financial aid, but also, you know, making internships a possibility, because now paid internships a possibility, right? Or having work experience. So I think that shifted a lot of things on college campuses. And I think at least at the UCs at that time, there was also the Janet Napolitano, right? The former, head of the Department of Homeland Security became our president. So she actually, committed a large chunk, millions of dollars in funding for the creation of undocumented student services. So that's also where you see a diversion between UC and Cal States, right? And I would say before, there was a tendency for folks to go to community college or go to Cal State to make it more affordable. Whereas now I would say actually the UCs, because of all the institutional aid that's available, in some cases is more affordable than Cal State.
I mean, that's a big difference, because the way we're talking about it, at one point, folks were just coming together and forming clubs and providing support networks with each other. And like you said, that led to the creation of things being in place and access being given at certain times. But now, like, where you're at, there's an actual building for it. There's a center for it. You know, it's more institutionalized and normalized.
Yeah, it's definitely institutionalized now. I mean, we have a center, they have a budget. Part of it is on temporary funds, right? But there's also commitment from, you know, campus funds to fund two, you know, professional full-time staff positions. There's students that are working out of there. So I think that there's just a lot of support now, particularly at the UCs. This new project that I'm doing actually compares UC and Cal State undocumented student experiences. Yeah. Right now I'm looking at sort of what's going on there, what's different. We're seeing a lot of differences, but also some similarities. But I think there's a lot to the institutional context that's going to really affect your experiences, particularly.
Yeah. I remember a couple of years ago when this campaign was going around where folks were being more open about being supportive of undocumented students and putting up posters where, you know, it explicitly said, oh, this is a safe space for undocumented students and things like that. I think even you had one like that, right?
Yeah, I think there was a big push out of like the student affairs professional conference, and there was a couple of groups that were doing a lot of work there. But now I'd say a lot of universities and community colleges also have, I think pretty standard is like an ally program. So they do like ally training, and you get a sticker if you go through training as a way to...
Shit, really? Oh, wow. I've been out of school for, I don't know how long.
I mean, it was really revolutionary when it happened, right? And that was undocumented students, you know, demanding the creation of one and asking for it. So I think, but now, for the most part, I feel like it's become fairly common. That there's these trainings. How good the trainings are, different issue, but they exist.
it's good that they're there, and I was just, they kind of have to grow into themselves.
I mean, I have feelings about ally training, because a 4-hour training doesn't make you an ally. Mm. You know, like an allyship is a continual process. It's like a continual commitment to learning. And to working with a community. It's not taking a 4-hour training and then saying that you get it, because you don't get it in 4 hours. I mean, I've been doing this for over a decade, and I get it, but I don't get it.
Yeah, even me being undocumented, I was like, I don't get it sometimes.
Yeah, I mean, right, because it's still, but you know, it's very complicated,
It's shifting, it's always shifting.
It is always shifting, yeah. Right. So your experiences, you know, maybe talking to a 18-year-old first year undergraduate student is going to be very different.
Yeah, that's one thing I always did enjoy was when, you know, you were in the middle of your work and well, sometimes you created these opportunities and sometimes they just open up on their own where you invited folks like me, you know, to come to talk to students and share my experience. And now looking back on it, it's like, wow, I talked a lot. Now, I mean, I talk a lot in general, right? But just being in those spaces where you're inviting me or you're giving me a space to share those experiences so other folks can learn from it. Yeah, I think the biggest thing I took away from that was that my experience was, like, very insular. So, you know, I graduated high school 2002. I didn't start college 2005. And even then, I didn't know anything about the movement until I got after college. So, you know, these kids have obviously a little bit more of a heads up in terms of that there's support networks, that the school they're at probably has a support group or a club or a center. And yeah, those early days were really just more about building that connection that, you know, you weren't alone, you know, there's support networks. And, you know, if you get a scholarship, there's ways around getting it. And really, it's like life hacks, honestly, where we were just passing them down from one another, sharing email lists about scholarships you could apply to and all that other stuff. It was just, I think at one point I just took it for granted because it was just the norm. That's just what we had to do. And that's what everybody after us will continue doing and building up on it. So it's interesting to reflect a lot on.
It is. It's very different now too. Like, I think that it's an interesting way to negotiate. So at one point, there was a lot of conversation at the Dream Center about like, oh, we're not getting enough students come in. And that's like a problem. We're not students don't want to come to us. Why don't they want to come to us?
Well, if you go there, you're going to out yourself.
Well, so there's one way, but there's also a way of thinking about it as if like students have become normal students, so that like we've been able to normalize the undocumented students' access to resources, that you don't need a center because you're just like any other student, right? And isn't that the goal of all this institutional work, is basically to make you feel like you don't need a center because yeah. you're just like anybody else. If that's true or not, probably not, right? But students might feel that way, that they don't need it, but they probably actually...
I mean, if I was in school right now, that would be very comforting, obviously, because, you know, you can see that you're not being singled out as much as you would, like, if you had to, because you're undocumented and you don't know who to go to and who to talk to about it.
Yeah, you don't need, like, the special handoff, right? Or the, like, oh, this is the person who's going to help you out, because all of the people can help you out, you know? Mm-hmm. So.
I will say, though, I mean, that kind of, this has been one of my, like, observations, that this very much, and I think you'll be able to understand it, that this kind of this feeling that we built all of this up and now all these kids get to enjoy all of it, which is the point, right? That we fought for all of that stuff, we advocated for all of that stuff, and now it's become institutionalized. But there's still a part of me that's like, you kids don't know how things were back then. Like, I don't know I don't know where that comes, but so it's a very weird feeling, because I mean, it shouldn't be like, you kids don't know, da, 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 da. It's like, yeah, enjoy that, you know?
I mean, I think it's also that it's not that you don't want them to have those things, right? But it's that you want them to recognize what blood, sweat, and tears, right, contributed to you having these things. And it's kind of like a know your history.
Yeah. I mean, that's a whole other issue, because none of this is really documented in any kind of way, at least formally. It's always been orally, or like kind of like the way we're talking about it, where we can give you a brief window into that period, but we can't give you the whole story, because there's so many people involved and so many people that are part of it. And it never was just one person that's like, that's our person right there, they're the face of all of this. Now it kind of seems more like that, because you have social media and everybody wants to be a brand, but back then wasn't really about that. And well, I mean, by default, sometimes it was me, because I would be the only one that said yes to interviews.
Yeah, I think, but also before that, there was like the couple of people that were always interviewed, right? Like there was the poster children.
Yeah.
But it's different now.
Yeah, the media always wants a very specific set of like criteria for folks to interview. But that's a whole nother podcast. This is a random question. Have you come across any like undocumented or like any other type of media, like podcasts or things like that? I know they're out there, but I mean, it's not in my...
I don't know. And, you know how I'm not up with the social media and all the things that kids do these days. That's not my strong suit.
Because I mean, because as we're talking about how the resources are institutionalized and places are making it easier for folks to be able to access it, I keep thinking back that when we were organizing, we had more of the social media that we have now. I'm sure there must have been some. I mean, there was Undocumented Media for a while, where like it's a very specific Instagram account that shares resources and provides support for folks and helps them. But now I can't think of an account that does that kind of work specifically, other than the account for like some nonprofit.
Yeah, I think actually the Dream Center here just started a podcast that the students are developing. I probably should listen to it since I'm the faculty in residence. But I think that's more, you know, by and for undocumented students, just kind of talking about experiences and processing things.
Well, specifically at the school too, yeah. Not like at the broader spectrum.
Yeah.
That's cool though. I'm glad to see the folks still being creative about it and putting out different ways to share their stories. Because, yeah, like I said, my experience was so much more different than theirs that I'm super curious and would want to listen to their experience now and how they're navigating things.
I will share the podcast link with you.
Yeah. So with that being said, let's get into the book. So Of Love and Papers, How Immigration Policy Affects Romance. Like you said, you were doing this research work already as, you know, when you were doing your master's, and then you decided to narrow it down. Do you, I mean, I think you kind of answered this already, where it was kind of like a gradual thing where it turned into that, but did you have a definitive point where you said, all right, this is where I start focusing on romantic relationships?
I think that happened sort of at different points in time. I mean, so the story that I start the book with is about being in a organizing space with three young men, all undocumented, and them talking about dating as we're like making posters for an event, right? And we spend a lot of time making posters for an event, and, you know, there's just time to burn.
I never got any better.
No, we already talked about my lack of art skills. So, you know, you got to pass the time as you're making posters. And they were talking about dating fiascos, right? So being turned down on dates, being turned down because they don't drive, not having enough money, not feeling comfortable asking people out, not feeling stable. I mean, just kind of joking around. But the fact that a joking around conversation, right, about dating lasted, you know, half an hour, and it went back and forth between joking but also very serious, you know, I was like, this is like a real thing that isn't just something that I was negotiating in my relationship, because I, you know, am born in the U.S. And I'm a U.S. citizen, but my husband is formerly undocumented. And at that time was undocumented when we were dating for, well, until he got DACA and then we got married. So we were negotiating being in a relationship, but I just kind of was like, that's just our thing. But being in this space and being like, oh, it's not just something that me and him are negotiating, like this is a broader thing. And then one thing I actually didn't include in that beginning of the book is that, you know, at the end of that conversation, another undocumented woman walked in and was like, what are you talking about? And became a conversation about how she's able to negotiate dating while being undocumented. And she was like, no, these are not problems for me, because she was a woman, right? She's like, oh no, like I just get free meals. It's like not a big deal. And I was like, oh, there's like a huge gender. So I think that was a really important moment for me to be like, this is important. And like, I need to pay attention to this. And that's the time that I was preparing my dissertation proposal. So I wrote this stuff in there, and was like, okay, yes, I'll look at education, I'll look at work, like whatever you want me to look at, right? The standard things. But then I was like, but I'm putting this romance and family stuff in there, and we're going to talk about dating and marriage and kids and what that looks like. And then those were my favorite part of the interviews, right? That's where people were just like, oh, that's, you know, like, that's interesting, when the interview started, that piece of it. And then once the dissertation was done, I was like, that was the stuff that I wanted to write about. So that then, you know, became a book. There was enough there.
I can see that, because, I mean, I'm in the book, I've done some of these interviews, and to me, when we were talking about it, it never felt like a formal interview, right? Because it was. You were collecting data, you were recording, you were taking notes. But because the nature of the conversation is about relationships, it felt more like we were just, like you said, we were, and because we had an existing friendship, it felt more like we're just talking as friends about my experience. And you mentioned this in the book too, that having that, like, well, as you said, you have an activist cred, that you were part of groups, you were part of clubs, you know, your partner was undocumented at the time, that opened the doors for folks to feel more comfortable with you, to talk about it, to be able to want to talk about it. Because what folks, I think some folks might not know, is that I interviewed a bunch of people. Well, I've had a bunch of people interview me about being undocumented and what that was, especially back then, because that's when so many folks were writing about it. But rarely do I get to see the work come back or get to see the research, you know, in its final form and its report in the book or whatever. And yours is one of those rare ones where, you know, you're actually building relationships with folks and you want them to see what happened, right? What came of the all those interviews and all those hours and in this case years of work that matured.
I mean it's been a long time, and there's part of me that feels kind of guilty about that, because I know so much history, right, about being like extractive researchers who come in and take stories and roll out and don't really do them justice, right? And I, it was really important to me to not replicate that, to really have people's experiences to do justice to the stories, right? That sharing all of these things, and sometimes very painful things, right, was for a purpose, and that folks were going to read it, that we're going to understand, you know, how just how deep immigration policy reaches, right, into your romantic relationships. Like, that's how far it goes into your decisions about kids, into decisions about when you're going to get married, how you're going to structure your marriage and your romantic relationship and that relationship with your partner that you're able to develop, right? Those are very personal things that we think, right? Love will conquer all. And I've had several participants that say that to me, right? Love will conquer all and it's going to be fine. But it's not. Like, that's just how pervasive immigration policy is. And I think that I wanted to make sure that the stories conveyed that, but also that the people that were interviewed could maybe find some solace in that. Like, I felt like there was a lot of guilt in a lot of my conversations, right? A lot of, you know, I feel like I got a lot of confessions sometimes, things that I've never told anybody this, but this is, you know, whatever, you know. And like a lot of insecurity, a lot, you know, which comes with any romantic relationship, but I think is doubled down because of immigration policy and how you don't want your status to affect these things. And there's just a lot of baggage to unpack there, and there hasn't been opportunities to do that. So I really wanted the book also to be for the people that I interviewed. So when I was writing, I was thinking about them or people like them, right, who could read it and find connections, right, and feel like they're not the only one that feels this way, and this is not their fault that they feel this way. In the same way that when I read this book in undergrad and I was like, oh, this is why I don't speak Spanish, right? And this is why, like, it's not me, it's not my failing, it's not my parents' failing. Like, it is an institutional thing that I can now point to and make, you know, and kind of process some of that and begin to work through that. So I'm really hoping that comes out in the book and that folks are able to find that space, whether or not they were actually interviewed.
Yeah, and the funny thing too
can relate
is
to
that,
it in another way.
Like you said, you were in school, you were doing research, and then one thing led to another, and you said, like, this is when I do it, what I'm going to do my research on. But turns out we also have, like, this informal history of kind of doing this kind of stuff as well in terms of public events and interviews in news organizations. So the first thing I can point to, and we were talking about this and reflecting before recording, was in December of 2010. That was the year, you know, it was a big push for the Federal Dream Act. It didn't happen. And that was, I mean, all of that went down October, November. By December, it was the end of the year, right? Everything was winding down. Nobody was really thinking about that. And I forget how these details came about, but eventually we got to the point where, like, we should have a panel discussion about dating and being undocumented. And one thing led to another. We ended up getting folks to be on the panel, myself included, and we ended up doing it at Self Help Graphics. And yeah, I mean, that, I think you, like you said, that really showed that there's a real need in the undocumented community to talk about just relationships in general and how folks are dealing with them and navigating them and how they feel about it and reflecting on it and just, yeah, because, I mean, we had a couple of different folks from different perspectives in terms of what their experience was dating and what was going on. And in that everybody kind of shared their own individual experience, but they also, we saw the overlap of like some experiences because we were all undocumented. So yeah, ever since then, I was like, man, you and me, we've been at different points, been interviewed by different reporters for stories about undocumented relationships, mixed status relationships, mostly, I will say, by folks from KPCC.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you know, Valentine's Day comes around and you have to talk about love somehow, so.
Yeah, it's usually, I mean, well, now more you, because even this year, you did something for the LA Times. You wrote an op-ed in February, and you, again, they reached out to you, Orange County Register, when the DACA court decision was made. So, you know, you have more of that title now. We're like PhD teacher at UC Irvine. So
I guess I do have a title, and that's supposed to lend some credibility. But I think that anybody could, you could write an op-ed if you wanted to.
I don't want to anymore. I'm tired of being on
this is box. Probably more fun, right? Running your own podcast than writing.
It is. I mean, you understand better than anybody how, you know, the synergy that comes around when you're interviewing with somebody. And there's a little bit of awkwardness in the beginning because you're getting things started and then just get into it and you're just having a regular old-fashioned conversation. But yeah, there's a precedent to this talking about relationship and reflecting it. I will say though, I did want to mention this, that in that panel discussion that we had at Tough Up Graphics, you know, there, like any panel discussion, there was a Q&A portion. Your dad was there, and I think he hit the nail on the head where you could probably remember better what he said, but what I got from it was, he heard everything we were all talking about and what we were sharing. And at the end, he was like, well, it's like he kind of like summed it up that our problem wasn't that we were undocumented, is that we were just out poor or broke. It's the way I was like, whoa, hold on. I never thought about it that way. You're right. Because, I mean, it honestly, it should have money. If money's not an option, you can do a lot of things that, you know, whether you have access to it or not, you can get it done.
I mean, yeah, well, okay. I was like, it's complicated. We need to adopt an intersectional perspective to understand, right? That like being undocumented and being low income go hand in hand. Like they're connected, right? And so like that's one thing. So like, yes, a lot of the issues that emerge, right? Like a lot of the dating stuff, and even like, oh, am I ready to get married? Like a lot of these things that come up that folks credit to their undocumented status are tied to money, right? Not being able to pay for dates, not being able to support a family, not being able to pay for extracurricular activities for their kids, right? So yes, there are a lot of things that are tied to economic situations, but those are all structured by your immigration status, right? And your ability to access certain kinds of jobs, to access well-paid jobs with, you know, benefits and insurance and all kinds of things. So I think that they're connected. You can't just say it's one over and over, like one or the other thing, like they're related. And I think that's also, so that's like, that's part of that. But I think it's also that intersectional perspective is also what brings in like gender into that conversation, right? And that you can't just say it's one or the other. And you can see that very clearly with gender, because I can sort of untangle that within the book, because I have both men and women. I don't have like very poor and very rich undocumented folks. But like being a man creates a very different undocumented experience, particularly within romantic relationships, because of gendered expectations, right? In a way that women are not having to negotiate that. Right, so men are having a hard time dating, being able to feel confident in asking somebody out, being able to pick them up and drive them somewhere and pay for the date and look like a good match, because they're not able to perform these gendered expectations, whereas women don't have those things, right? If you sort of have these dependent gendered expectations for women that you're going to pick me up and you're going to pay and I'm going to do whatever, you know, I'm just going to be along for the ride, that you don't have to really negotiate your status openly in those times.
Yeah. And then that opens the door to like a completely different set of issues that, well, you know, folks have to deal with women identified folks. Cause then, yeah, that I mean, like anything else, that opens the door to violence and abuse and a bunch of other stuff that can go like super wrong super fast.
Yes. So I think there's a lot of, right? So you can see those differences, right? And like gender really affecting the way in which you experience your immigration status. And I think that status does that too, in the same way race does as well, right? And that's some of the other work that I've done around expectations of who is undocumented and being able to pass if you're not Latino and maybe pass as a citizen. And so not having to negotiate some things, but then also not having access to the support services because you're not targeted as a Latino person, right, for services connected.
Yeah, and it is worth pointing out, too, that out of the 200-plus folks you interviewed, 150, approximately, we don't have exact numbers, but approximately 150 of them were undocumented, and then the rest of the numbers make up folks who were citizens or permanent residents or a mixed bag. But I think it's safe to say the majority of folks, if not all of them, are Latino, Latinx?
Yeah, they're all Latino or Latina identified individuals. But yeah, they were mostly undocumented. But then I also interviewed a group of 30 folks who were formerly undocumented, so had legalized their status recently, and sort of talked through that process. And most of those had been able to legalize through marriage, right? Which is a very complicated process that's not available to a lot of people. But we were able to sort of talk through how that legalization process is you know, affected their decisions to marry and their experiences of marriage. And then I also interviewed any partner that would talk to me or that they would let me talk to. I mean, so the most part, people would let me talk to their, would refer me to their partners. And then whoever there would talk to me, I interviewed them as
well. Did folks kind of feel like, wait, I don't want you talking to them because you're going to badmouth me kind of thing?
Nobody. So everybody, I can't remember really anybody not referring me to their partner. But for the most part, people were okay with it. I did a lot of, and like, there was a lot of intention in the lead up to the ask about not being like, I'm not going to tell them what you said. I'm not going to tell you what they said. Right. And making sure both groups are aware of that. And then even while writing, trying to be very intentional to make sure that, that the partners can't figure each other out, or if I am putting them in conversation with each other, I guess controversial things, right? I like will remove a name or not name them or something. But if I am putting them in conversation with each other as partners, that they both were talking about the same incident or something like that, so that I know that they're kind of already on the same page, that I'm not like opening up a box of drama, basically, right?
It's like I read in chapter 2, paragraph 3.
Yes, I was trying to avoid.
Yeah, no. So something also very interesting that came about both in your research and as you yourself were writing this is the DACA loophole. Can you tell folks what that is?
The DACA loophole.
I don't even think
I've never heard it referred to that way.
What is it? Does it have an official title?
I'm assuming you mean like your ability to act to legalize.
Yeah, when you go in and out.
So a lot of the barrier, right, to legalization through marriage is because folks have like entered without inspection, right? So they cross the border, and so they're not able to process their legalization applications within the United States. They'd have to return to the country of origin, right, and process a consular case, which, you know, has to prove hardship to the citizen petitioner and is very difficult, right? Is just very scary. Right? Because you may not be able to return. You may be barred from the country for 10 years. Like, it's just a very complicated, uncertain process.
And that's just under quote unquote normal time.
Right, right. So this is under, you know, like really positive. And I interviewed some people that went through the process successfully and were able to negotiate that. But it, you know, but it's very, most people don't go through that process because of the uncertainty and the risk that it carries, right? Especially now, like under our current administration. So you know, this was kind of a thing that was preventing people from accessing legalization petitions. It was something that was also affecting my own relationship because my husband had been entered without inspection. But I was actually doing an interview with somebody who had entered without inspection, and he had DACA and was planning to travel with, I think with Salif.
Oh, the program they have, yeah,
the
to take
program they
books.
had. So he went to
Yeah.
El Salvador, even though he's like Mexican. He went to El Salvador, and when you re-enter with your advanced parole, you enter with inspection because you have permission. And so then you have inspection, and you're able to process within the country through the regular process that's significantly less risky, and much more straightforward and fast. So yes, that's a loophole if you want to frame it that way. So that
Well, I mean, it's not like people are like trying to find like a way in, right? That's not already there. I would say like a better way to frame it would be this is bureaucracy, just.
Yeah, it's definitely like working the immigration system, right? And taking and you ha I mean you have to know it, and you have to know how it works. You have to have access to something that's going to allow you to apply for advanced parole, so right? So it's still and then that's very expensive. So it's a very privileged position to be in to have DACA to be able to justify an advanced parole application and pay for it. To be willing to risk that and think that you'll be able to negotiate it or employ a lawyer if you need to, like negotiate that process. And then once re-entering, then also take on the lawyer expenses of that and have a citizen partner or child who can petition you, right? So there's lots of privileged things that go into that process. But it's definitely so that was how so I learned that from an interviewee and then did it with my husband. Basically, another interviewee referred us to the lawyer that she had used to do that. So I interviewed two folks that were doing that. Well, during the time I was doing interviews, and then me and my husband went through that process as well. And then later on, actually, I was doing a follow-up interview with somebody, and he was asking me questions about that process because he was about to. So I feel like there was a lot of network, especially in that time period, where folks were trying to learn.
Yeah, I've always been just, because I'm nosy like that, been super curious about how that was discovered, because it's not like somebody was going through the, like the legalese language of how it is. I mean, obviously an immigration lawyer would have, and somebody like, who's researching it constantly would have a much more aptitude for it, but it's like, how did folks just figured that would work,
I mean, so initially, like I learned after reading about it that that provision was created around temporary protected status, right? So TPS, because TPS allows for or allowed for advanced parole. So there had been already cases that like there was case law established around TPS and advanced parole to open up that pathway. So I don't know like how widespread that information became, but I mean like. There's immigration lawyer networks that have issued, information on how to do that. And I think immigration lawyers are sort of connected. And the first person that I interviewed who went through that had been working with a lawyer and was like kind of, so I think that it's the other person I interviewed was doing like trans like official translation stuff for a lawyer. So I think it's folks that maybe are more connected, right, already to lawyers or are seeking legal counsel.
Paralegal working in an office. Yeah, the system, it's just weird like that. But we got to take advantage of it where we can. So the book you started doing this research 2011, the first wave, 2011 through 2012. You interviewed hundreds of folks, came back about a few years later and did the second wave, 2014 to 2015. How was it, overlooking everything from the first wave to the second wave and then compiling everything to get it done as you started working on the book?
It was a lot. It's right. That's just a lot of interviews and a lot of information to process. I mean, I should say that. So I did those interviews, and then I was like, "Hey, I'm gonna write." And then DACA happened, right, 2012. So I was like, "This changes everything." Right? Like it changed everything, right? DACA has been really critical in changing how people experience their immigration status. And so I was like, well, what's the point of writing this book if this is not the experience anymore? Let me go back and interview everybody again. But also by that time, I realized that I really wanted to write the book on families and romantic relationships. So I wanted to go back and ask more detailed information about a lot of different aspects of these sort of family experiences. That I knew that I wanted to talk to romantic partners to see how they were experiencing it. So I really went back and really delved a lot more deeply into sort of romance and family, but also DACA and how it has shifted those experiences. So yeah, it was a lot. I was like, I don't know how I did it. I don't have an answer for you. I mean, like one foot in front of the other, one chapter at a time. I think that's kind of where it was. And you can kind of see in the book, it's really the first half of the chapter is more the undocumented experience and the early experience. And then the second half is more of the second wave, post DACA, and what kind of shifted. So that kind of helped me negotiate the two sets of data by sort of organizing it chronologically.
Nice. Yeah. We have to take a step back and remind ourselves, just, you know, do it one step at a time.
One paragraph at a time, however painful it is.
And so much happened. I mean, like you said, in terms of your research, DACA happened, so that shifted things. But then in your own personal life, like you said, you got married, you have two beautiful kids now, like so much was happening. So it's just, you know, a testament to you and your work and your commitment to it, because so much happened. And yeah, you know, you say this, that, you know, you kind of feel bad, but given the nature of the work and how much of it is so important to folks and just, you know, just so many folks talking to you, it's understandable that it took you so long, because it's not easy, right? And like you said, you wanted to make sure that folks felt that they were being listened to and heard and validated, and not just you're coming in and you're gonna listen to them and take their stories and do your thing with it, and that's it. Yeah, so that's kind of brings me to the next question I want to ask you, which you wrote in your book about this term, me-search. What is me-search?
Me-search is what people yell at you when they don't like what you're doing. me-search is when you study something that affects you, right? You study yourself. So this is something that's often thrown, and I say thrown, like I think it's kind of hurled, or like, yeah, just that's what it feels like scholars of color, right? Marginalized scholars who want to study something related to their own communities, right? And I think that that's often used as a way to invalidate, right, the work that they're doing, that somehow they're too close to it, that they need to be objective observers that have no connection and no passion and no emotion, and that will make their research better. I've experienced that, right? But I also witness it a lot with the students that I work with, both undergrad and graduate students, and also, like, you know, my colleagues who have a hard time negotiating that, right? Because they sometimes, right, internalize those feelings, right? And don't recognize it for what it is, as, like, who cares what these other people think? That's basically how I deal with it. It's like, I don't care if you think it's me search. This is important. And my connection to it makes it stronger. So I actually talk about that in the methodological appendix, because I wanted folks to know that it was okay. And because that was, whenever I was talking to like graduate students or undergrads about my work in academic settings, like that was always the question. It's like, well, how do you deal with this? They're trying to figure out, how do I de-emotionalize myself, right? How do I stay objective? And I was like, I'm not, like, it's not objective, and that's fine. So that was really the audience that I had in mind for that appendix, was folks trying to negotiate that, these sort of accusations of me search and that invalidating their work, when actually I feel like that's the strong work, right? That's the interesting work, like that's the important work that needs to get done. And I wanted the students trying to do that work to have the tools to be able to push back on this narrative that it's not valid.
Yeah, you double down that, you know, this is important to you, because, I mean, it is intersecting with your life, but it's also because, yeah, I agree that, you know, that's, I mean, that's part of the reason why I left journalism altogether at one point, because objectivity is it doesn't help us in any way. It's just the way the systems are. And for me, you know, writing about my community, and it's almost impossible to be objective, because I have those intimate knowledge of how things are. And then to outsiders, they don't understand that. So it's like, well, we're not writing to you.
No, I think that that's where the more innovative work comes from. We actually, this UC-wide collaborative that I run, we're bringing on 5 graduate students and funding them to do some work with our newly collected survey data. And actually, 4 of the 5 we selected are have strong connections, right, to undocumented communities. And that and they had the very innovative ideas and ways of thinking about the work that was sort of asset-based, that was grounded in knowledge of communities, of undocumented communities, of mixed status families, of you know, student experiences, and immigrant families, in ways that just made their work, you know, light years beyond some of the other proposals, because they were asking questions that were just very innovative, right? Different and insightful, and really, really getting at things that other people hadn't thought about before.
Yeah, I definitely agree with you there. And that's amazing that, you know, at your position, you're still teaching, you're still doing all this extra work, and really just paving a way for, like, for other folks, both undocumented students who are coming into higher education and folks in your specific line of work with researchers, and, you know, doing this work in a very stifling, very, you know, stale environment. So it's refreshing to read something that's more thought out and with more intention, other than like, I'm gonna research this and make a name for myself.
I tried. I hope it spoke to you you got to read it. Can I ask, what was your favorite part?
Well, for me, it's just honestly, because I mean, we get at this a little bit. We call it gossip, the cheese man, right? But honestly, it really is just listening to, well, in this case, reading other people's experience about what they were going through, and seeing that connection that, yeah, at that time, in that mindset, in that level of maturity that I had, I was also going through the same thing. And hearing other folks' experience, and like we were talking about earlier, hearing the experience from non-cis men and what they had to go through and what they dealt with is also like, wow, you know, it takes me out of my box of where I'm at and what I experience, and to be able to read it and be able to understand it in that context of the whole spectrum of the experience of dating while undocumented is, yeah, that's I think what really made me connect more to it than anything. And of course, you have, you know, a bunch of stats and graphs and data to supplement and prove all of that. So that's always comes in.
It's like, I don't know if there's a bunch, but yeah, just that's the first chapter. And that's the obligatory literature chapter. Just skip to chapter 2. It's more interesting.
It took me a while to realize that.
Oh, yeah. No, you just read the first like 3 pages of the intro, and then you just skip on to the next chapter.
Yeah, good to know. So hopefully, you know, from this conversation, folks would want to pick it up. Yeah, and where can folks find your book?
So you can find it anywhere you buy your books, wherever that might be. But there's also a free ebook available. So you can download that from a variety of places. But probably the easiest way to figure that out is my website. So if you go to my website, if you just Google Laura Enriquez UCI.
That's literally what I did.
Yeah, that's what I do to find my website too. So if you just Google Laura Enriquez UCI, you'll find my website, and there's links all over it to find my.
And of course, I'll include the direct link to Laura's website and for the book in the episode description. So, you know, a little less Googling going on, and just get right to it. But yeah, you know, thank you so much, Laura, for making time. It was great catching up. And then before I forget, who did the cover for the book?
Christy Sandoval, who is a artist that you actually connected me to. I love the cover. It's the best part of the book, but that's not. But the book is good itself too. You should get it just for the cover. It is actually based on my wedding picture. Did you know that?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So she made that beautiful, and I am absolutely in love.
Awesome. So yeah. So I'll have more details about the book in the episode description. And yeah, thanks again, Laura, for taking the time. It was awesome. And I don't think you have any social media you want to share with folks, huh? But if you listen to this and you do want to get in contact with Laura, always feel free to reach out to me. You know, you can find me on social media, L Random Hero, and I'll be more than happy to connect you. You know, maybe you know somebody that's going to be going to school there, or you want to get help with resources, something like that. Or maybe you're in the same field and you're a teacher and you want to make another teacher friend.
I will love to talk to anybody. I mean, definitely they can connect to me through you or email me. Also works, you know, that old-fashioned thing.
Yeah.
Now email is old-fashioned. So just laura.enriquez@uci.edu.
So thank you again, Laura. Thanks, everybody, for listening, and catch you on the next one.